Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Dan and Peter Haig. And we have a nice lineup, as always, don't we, Rabbit?
We sure do.
And it's always a treat to interview, well, just first of all, just see the new book that Virginia Willis has written. It's called This One, Secrets of the Southern Table. And she really knows her stuff, Virginia. A smart, smart lady. And I love talking to her.
And curiously enough, one of her very best friends from the Southern agricultural community comes up second in the program.
Exactly.
They're friends for years and years and years. And both Virginia and...
The Harrises.
The Harrises are...
Will and Jenny will be up after Virginia.
And they're an illustration of something that... A lot of the times we forget as we drive around the United States or fly around the United States, we forget what a very rural country this is.
Yeah.
So here are some reminders of the fact that we're Americans are farmers the old-fashioned way as well. Anyway, Virginia first, right?
Right. Virginia Willis has another major hit on her hand. Actually, Peter did a great description of this cookbook. It's called Secrets of the Southern Table. And, well, Virginia Willis has been a really prized food writer and cookbook author for a long time. But this one takes the cake, Virginia. I mean, there's so many cookbooks that come across our desk about Southern cooking. And boy, after reading this, I have so many more questions to ask you about Southern cooking than I had going into reading the book.
Well, that makes me excited that you found it so interesting. Thank you so much.
And Peter says it's not a cookbook, it's...
Well, it's a cookbook, but it's also a piece of social history.
Yes.
And I think you, Virginia, you intended it to be that way, so I'm sure you're not surprised that I say so, but... What was behind this idea that you would have two people who are intimately involved with Southern food for each chapter, and you would introduce them and talk about how they got involved in Southern food and what they're doing now?
Well, I've traveled in my career. I travel a lot. I go to different places, and I spend a fair amount of time outside of the South. And I began to realize that I think that many people outside of the South don't really understand the South and don't really understand Southern food and cuisine. I wanted people to understand. I live outside the South sometimes. I travel quite a bit, and I began to understand that people didn't really understand the fabric of how everything sort of comes together. So I wanted to very much introduce readers to different harvesters and makers and artisans, and I wanted to, and I believe I've accomplished, to introduce readers to a vast and rich, diverse population of Southern people.
It's about the South. In a different way. I mean, if you ask your average Yankee what he thinks the South is like, he'll think of Atlanta.
Right.
If he's really sophisticated or she's really sophisticated, they might think about Birmingham, Alabama, but probably not. They might think about New Orleans, Louisiana, or Memphis, Tennessee. But they'd be thinking in terms of places which are cities. And there's this whole other landscape of the South, which is still extraordinarily rural and agricultural. And I didn't realize the extent to which it was until I read a lot of your book.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, my dear friend, photographer Angie Mosier and I traveled to 11 states over the course of 8 months, not consecutively, but we'd go off on a trip and come back and go off on a trip and come back. And so we went to Texas, and that's where, you know, the Vietnamese shrimpers in Texas. There's this one sort of dimensional or two-dimensional view, I think, of the South, that it's only black and white. And there is a tremendous amount of black and white people in the South, but there are also many other cultures, and some are newer, some are older. All of those things to come together to sort of make up this quilt of what the South is. So you know, Vietnamese shrimpers in Texas, or the story about the tortilla maker in Lexington. You know, I wanted to have a variety of stories that reflected what people assume about the South, you know, the Kentucky ham maker. But I also wanted to share some things that people may not know about the South and Southern food.
You had two very interesting, at least two very interesting farmers, if you like, who were post-slavery, but not too long post-slavery, that they actually managed to get their farms, and they've kept them going since then. I thought they were some of the more catching stories.
Well, those I start the book off with, so there's 10 chapters, as you know, and there's two stories per chapter, and then a selection of 10 recipes per chapter. And I started with my friend Will Harris from White Oak Pasture.
Right.
And he is a fantastic man, used to be a commodity beef farmer. And then about 15 or so years ago, he just decided that wasn't what he wanted to do anymore. It's now the largest organic farm in Georgia. But his farm was founded when his ancestor returned home for fighting for the Confederacy in the Civil War. And the other story in that chapter is about my friend Matthew Rayford, whose family farm was founded when his ancestor was emancipated because of the Civil War. And I felt like that was a really great place to start. It features sort of the two poles, so to speak, of what people think about when they think of the South in terms of race. It speaks to the Civil War. It speaks to the African-American contributions to cuisine. And it also speaks, I think, the South is an agricultural economy still and always has been.
Very richly endowed.
That was the part of it that caught me. Now, help me out with this one, because I maybe just didn't read far enough along. But you had a couple in there, and they had a rural farm. And then all of a sudden they weren't going to farm anymore.
So one of the things that I very intentionally put together when I put together those stories is that I wanted to make sure that I covered a range of races, a range of gender, and a range of ages. And I just worked so hard on trying to cover as much as possible in a fairly, you know, tight section. So that particular story is about Many Fold Farm, and it's a young couple.
That's who it is.
And the average age of a farmer across the United States and in Georgia, where they are located, is 57. So the average age of a farmer is a 57-year-old white man. But this young couple have a farm. They had just stopped. When it went to press is when some things changed, which I felt like also indicated just how hard it is for young farmers. But, you know, the part that drew me to them to the beginning was not only their youth, but also it was this incredibly rural farm, but only 30 minutes from the world's busiest airport.
Amazing.
You know, at the edge of Atlanta, you know, it really does just sort of fall off into the country. And Atlanta is this, you know, thriving metropolis, and yet there's the country just right outside the door.
Right. Yeah. Now, what happened to them? We don't know the story?
They have quit producing their cheeses, which is sad.
Right.
But what happened there is that they reached a point that they couldn't produce enough milk to produce the cheese that they wanted to produce. And yet, if they had changed their business model and imported milk to produce the cheese, they would have lost the values that they had about growing their own, raising their own livestock.
Right.
So they're still working with chickens and doing different things. But it draws attention to the fact that just how hard it is to be a small farm and to have these sort of local, hyper-local values and the tipping point, and at the end of the day, it's a business arrangement, right? So
yeah.
It all matters. All of these things come together to matter.
Now, the Quail Man, he's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, Give us the statistics out of the book. How many quail eggs a day, and
it's hundreds of thousands. It's completely fascinating. Manchester Farms Quail is a family owned business in Columbia, South Carolina. It's owned by Brittany Miller and her husband. She's the quail lady. Her father is the gentleman that founded the farm. And it's really fantastic. You know, if you read stories in the paper or in the online about poultry farms, and you know, there's a terrible like environmental pollution and labor practices and the 100% turnover rate, and then you have someone like Manchester Farms, where they have multiple generations working for them. It's the cleanest of anything that you could possibly imagine, and they produce a really beautiful product. And it's just those family stories, I think, are just so it's good news in a bad world, right?
Absolutely. Now that we've talked about Clamor Dave so many times, I don't really think I want to put him in the program again.
Oh, come on, he's
an amazing character.
He sure is.
Yeah. So Clamor Dave, he is quite famous, and he, you know, for those who haven't heard of him, he raises clams off the coast of South Carolina near Charleston. And his clams are fantastic. And he also has created these oysters. This way of harvesting oysters. Oysters in the Lowcountry grow in clusters. And they're typically in Lowcountry cuisine, they're just sort of piled up in burlap and steamed, and that's how they're consumed. They're not really eaten on the half shell. It's an ancient method that was once utilized by slaves, that the enslaved Africans, that the oysters were removed from their cluster and sort of hand-chiseled and then put back into the water. But, you know, the thing that I found so fascinating about Dave and can hear again and again is his passion for the ecology and the environment of the ocean.
Right. Yes, I mean, that's built into these people, and that's what makes it so special, I know.
Well, then you've got that other character from Anson Mills,
who quit what he was doing
so he could make really good corn.
Yeah. Right, no, Glenn Roberts from Anson Mills. And,
yeah,
you know, the thing
wonderful.
About that, you know, I mean, I think, I mean, Glenn knows more about grains than most people will ever know, and he's a seed saver, and it's not just it's more than, I mean, his grits are fantastic, and the rice is amazing, and he's brought back these heirloom grains. But, you know, the part that's so vital in that is that it's creating seed diversity, and we have this sort of, you know, industrial agriculture has put it where there's only one type of grain, and, you know, what happens if something happens to that grain? It could be quite problematic. So it was really fun and fascinating to try to assemble some of these stories. Some of the characters are more well known than others, but I hope that even the ones that are more well known, that I'm sort of sharing something different for somebody in my book.
Now let's tease our listeners with a few recipe gems.
I had a question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I could have one word. I can't get it up, Virginia. Well, I mean, I was going to say.
Thank you very much.
That, you know, you look through the recipes and you're going to find Greek style this and, you know, Cuban style pork. We know now that there have. Why is it that all these other places across the United States have Vietnamese influx of Mexican, and they don't end up with the same Southern cuisine? What is the ingredient that makes it Southern?
Well, I think that the piece that I always go back to is the South is an agricultural economy, and we have something sort of coming out of the ground or off a tree nearly 12 months out of the year. That's significant, you know, and
yeah.
So it may not be like the lettuce bowl of California, so to speak, but it's tremendous. You know, George is one, the number one producer of one of the top producers of chicken, of eggs. You know, it's many of the southern states, a vast part of their economy in this modern age is still agriculture. And the part that I found fascinating, you know, like the Greeks in Birmingham, you know, people have this sort of image of southern food and it's fried chicken and biscuits.
Yeah,
and that's true, right?
Yeah.
I love fried chicken.
Yeah.
And I love biscuits.
Yeah.
But there have been Greeks in the South since the 1800s. And, you know, New Orleans, Peter, you mentioned earlier. At one point in time, there was a direct trade route between Sicily and New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
So during the 1800s, there were more Italians in New Orleans than anywhere in the United States, including New York City. So that's where the muffalata came from, and that's where barbecue shrimp, which really is just the New Orleans style of shrimp scampi, came from. So it doesn't really take much to scratch the surface to see where these foodways have indeed influenced traditional southern foodways as well.
Have you seen the latest news of what they're going to do next in Georgia?
Lord, no, ma'am. I don't know.
They're importing, or they're trying to raise the pigs that they raise in Spain.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's my Will from Wyoke Pastures. He has the Iberico pigs.
Yeah, and he's going to make Iberico hams.
Yeah, yeah.
Out of our south. Ah, I love
no,
it.
No, it's. I mean, you know, it's fantastic. I mean, it's. He's very forward thinking. I mean, you know, we have the land, we have the ingredients, we have the technology and the capability to make world class food on par with Iberico.
He's going to feed the peanuts.
Yep,
I love it.
Well, why wouldn't he do that? I mean,
yeah,
the one kind of nut that Georgia probably doesn't have a lot of is acorns.
Yeah, acorns, right. But anyhow, Peter wanted you to spell out some of these recipes because they are, we're talking about all the background of your story, the storyline for your cookbook, but it is, after all, a cookbook as well. And you have some absolutely delectable recipes in here.
So why don't we start with cathead biscuits?
Yeah,
so it's the traditional cathead biscuits are called cathead biscuits because they're about the size of a cat's head. They're quite large. This is a term my grandfather used to use. This isn't something sort of made up or silliness off the internet. You know, the traditional biscuit would have been smaller. The fast food biscuits that one sees, like at fast food places, these grand, huge, enormous biscuits, that would not have been a typical size biscuit. That's sort of a more of a modern invention. But the cathead biscuits, you know, there's as many different kind of biscuit recipes as there are southern grandmothers, I always say. And
yeah.
This one is just a simple combination of all-purpose flour, baking powder, salt, butter, and buttermilk. And they're big, flaky, and I'm very proud of that spread on how to make biscuits in that book.
Yes, I mean, I almost am ready to make them myself. We used to always have biscuits with instead of shortbread with strawberry shortcake.
Oh, yes. So I have traditional recipes like that, but I also, you know, I also try to like branch out and to highlight some of the other cuisines. But the North Carolina pulled pork and the biscuits, and of course I've got shrimp and grits and cornbread. So I feel like it's a nice balance of what someone would be looking for a fresh take on southern food, and then also some of these other more global influences.
Yeah, what's a prime example of this mashup recipe idea that you have in this book?
One of my favorites is actually, it's the bulgogi. It's a beef glazed short ribs. It's not really a mashup as much as it is just, it's really my version of an authentic Korean recipe. There's a tremendous Korean population in Atlanta. Not only are Koreans moving from Korea, but also from New York and L.A. because the cost of living is lower and the standard of living is higher. So on the outskirts of Atlanta and Duluth, it's called the Soul of the South.
Oh, wow.
And it's just, you know, mile after mile of these incredible Korean markets and grocery stores and restaurants. It's very cosmopolitan.
Well, once again, Virginia, we need to congratulate you on a job really, really, really well done.
Oh, thank you.
And a side of the South that Americans should spend more time finding out about.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. I'm so happy to share this with your listeners.
Well, it's such a great part of the heritage of these United States.
And congratulations also to your friend photographer. Oh, wow.
Yeah, Andy's fantastic.
So we love it, and we can't wait to try some of these.
No, I can't wait to hear what you think. I'm so excited, and it's always such a pleasure to talk to you.
And you too, Virginia. Good luck with your book. Success. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And we'll be back with one of Virginia's favorite farmers right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. When I read about EMET, tasted the products of white oak pastures and talked to Will Harris and his daughter, Jenny, I felt I had discovered another great treasure here. I'm putting you, Will, in a category I've established called my philosopher farmers. You know what you're doing. You do it all right. And I just thank God for you.
and the story begins in 1866.
Right. It's a great story.
And were it not for Virginia Willis, it might still be a secret.
Yeah, but I'm not going to rest until we go there and stay in one of those cabins.
Absolutely. Sounds like a plan.
Okay.
Well, we're going to be talking to Jenny and Will Harris, when I first contacted them, about their white oak pastures farm. I did so because I had read that they were raising these pigs, the Pata Negra pigs that in Spain they use they feast on acorns and they use them to make Iberico ham, which is very prized throughout the world. And then I read the whole story of this beautiful white oak pastures farm in Virginia Willis's book about the New Southern Table. And the story of it just captured my imagination. I'd say, Jenny, you are now the fifth generation farming this land. And Will, you have witnessed the going from the old sustainable culture of farming through industrialized farming and this industrial farming, which is a totally different thing, and then you decided to go back to the old and better methods. It is a story. Can you describe briefly how that went?
Sure. My great-grandfather came here in 1866, 152 years ago, and started this farm. His son, Will Carter Harris, ran the farm. Then my father took over. His name was Will Bell Harris after World War II, and that was the era in which agriculture was industrialized, commoditized, and centralized. And he changed the farm in that way. I went to the University of Georgia in the 70s, majored in animal science. I came home and further industrialized the farm. It made it a monoculture of only cattle.
And that's what they taught you at school.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And in the mid-90s, I became increasingly conscious of the unintended consequences of that kind of farming, started changing it back to a multi-species, vertically integrated farm, gave up all the tools like antibiotics and hormone implants, pesticides, chemical fertilizers, etc. And today we pasture raise 5 different red meat species, cows, hogs, sheep, goats, rabbits, and hand butcher them here on the farm. We pasture raise 5 poultry species, chickens, turkeys, geese, guineas, ducks, and hand butcher them here on the farm. We raise certified organic vegetables, pastured eggs, and a bunch of smaller ancillary businesses that Jenny will tell you about that would never exist on their own but go to work in the organism that we call White Oak Pastures.
Now, White Oak Pastures, geographically, put a dot on the map for us, if you would, Will. This is where it is.
If you picture the state of Georgia, we're in the bottom left corner, southwest Georgia, almost Alabama, almost Florida, very, very rural.
I was reading the introduction from Virginia Willis's book. It described that there was not this kind of revival going on around you, and it actually set back the economy of your area. Tell us about that.
Well, this is the heart of really industrialized peanut, cotton production, commodity crops, very intense use of tillage, chemical fertilizers, and pesticides. And that kind of farming impoverishes rural areas. They don't, a very small number of people can work thousands of acres of land. The jobs don't pay very well. And White Oak Pastures employs 155 employees in the town of Bluffton, which has 98 people.
Oh, jeez.
And our average employee makes significantly more than the county average.
Now, it's funny. Virginia Willis talks about Bluffton and what's happened to it, and basically Bluffton has died and gone to heaven, right? Or maybe the other place.
Well, Bluffton, like many, many other towns in rural America, was sinking into oblivion or had sunk into oblivion simply because it had become irrelevant.
Right,
it was
right,
not
okay.
Needed anymore. And when we brought in all these passionate, talented, educated, energetic young people, the town became relevant again. So now we've got, we serve 7 meals a week at one of our 2 restaurants. We've got lodging. We build houses for employees. We've opened the general store.
You have a CSA going.
Refurbished the old church.
You have a CSA going too, right?
Yes.
Now, in a way, Will, this is sort of the whole venture is sort of almost like an accident, because when your ancestor started the farm, he just finished up on the losing side of a conflict. Was he a farmer before that, or did he discover farming because he just wanted to get away from what had happened to him?
No. My great-grandfather was from an old farming family.
Oh, okay.
Prior to the northern invasion. he was a cavalry captain for the Southern Army.
Yes.
And lost the farm that he had about 2 counties north of here in the conflict. So he was fortunate he had an uncle that started him over on this farm, as I said, in 1866, and that's how we came here.
Well, now, do you feel that you are on an upward spiral now, because you've brought new blood in into your operation, and or do you think that it's something that will attract your neighbors to do the same thing? I mean, are we looking at something that's hopeful for the future? With moving away from this industrial farming, there's some.
Well, sadly, I thought that that was the way it was going to be when I first started making the changes. I believed at that time that we were early innovators in changing the way food's produced in this country. But I really don't believe that anymore. I'm very pragmatic. Today, I recognize that I produce high-quality food for sophisticated consumers who care about the environment and animals and rural economic justice. I don't think that I serve a niche, and the niche is growing. I don't think it'll ever get very big. Sadly, this is a nation of big box shoppers.
Yeah, I know.
And I don't think, the consumer will decide how big this niche becomes.
Yeah,
and I don't have that much confidence in mankind.
Oh, dear.
You make an observation, I think, that other people have made as well, that America's food is too cheap.
It's obscenely cheap and wastefully abundant.
Right. So, but your reaction to that has been to specialize and to go for a quality of meat that only those who are willing to pay for it will appreciate.
And vegetables.
Yeah, right, and vegetables too.
And you have a totally contained operation where, your motors are powered by the products that you produce, right? Tell us about this zero waste thing that you do.
Well, we don't believe in waste streams. We believe in nutrient streams. George Washington Carver is a hero of mine, and he said, in nature there is no waste. And we endeavor to operate the farm that way. We take what could be construed as waste from our red meat and poultry packing plants and turn them into dehydrated organs for pets, the hides turn into leather for purses and leather products, bones for soup, organs that we package for resale for food, ethnic cultures love organ meats. We sell a lot of that.
Yeah, we do.
Anything that was not marketable, we turn into compost that we put back onto our pastures. We've got about 3,000 acres of pastures, and we don't use any chemical fertilizer. We use the compost that we make from the nutrient stream from the processing plants.
Now, one of the most interesting things, and it was a thing that led Anne to explore your activities just a little bit more, is these wonderful Iberico pigs that you decided, since there were a lot of peanuts in Georgia, that
they're going to eat peanuts, right?
Pigs might like peanuts. And Iberica pigs.
Peanuts and pecans.
Pecans and
okay,
peanuts.
There you go.
Okay.
So, but the Iberica pig is highly prized, assuming that you can get people to say, American Iberico is just as good as Spanish Iberica.
Well, it might be a little better. these pigs are finished on peanuts and pecans as opposed to acorns. And speaking for myself, I'd rather eat peanuts and pecans than acorns.
Yeah, Cesare A. Casella is doing this on Rhode Island. I thought that was a very unlikely place to raise pigs, but anyhow, he was after the Iberico. Jenny, where do you come into this picture? I mean, did you experience the industrial farming? Did you realize what you were experiencing? You were not around then, were you?
So I was born in 1986, so that puts me as 31 years old now. And I never saw it as industrial farming. It was, always full of father-daughter activities, and we did what we did because we didn't know any different. And so I went to school at Valdosta State University and got a marketing degree. And it wasn't until I got my first big girl job that I realized the differences in the products that we were producing versus the commodity, industrial products that I had become so familiar with. I worked at Buckhead Beef, which was a Sysco-owned subsidiary meat company in Atlanta. And I was able to learn a little bit about most of the departments there. I worked there for a year, and it was a wonderful experience, and I still talk to several of those people today. But it wasn't until I had that experience that I returned home to fully understand the different products that we were producing here at White Oak Pastures.
Yeah, we have a friend who actually is our nephew who was working in food service, and his exposure to all the industrial animal production system, he's now a vegetarian. And another vegetarian friend of ours grew up across from an abattoir in England. So there's a lot of stuff. But you can see the glory of the strategy of humane raising of these animals, allowing animals to behave like they're supposed to behave, and still fit this into our system of raising it for food, right?
It is. You know, my title is the Director of Marketing and Sales, and I'm constantly reminded that it's not really products that we're trying to sell to the end consumer. It's a production system that's,
exactly,
you know, intertwined relationships with land and animals and people, and that's really what we're marketing, is that production system, not a product. And so about the time I think I have something figured out, I learned that I've just scratched the surface.
Tell me this, Will. I mean, you have a big, long view of all this. How do you think it's going to play out? You already said that it's not going to be easy converting everybody to your thoughts and your philosophy of husbandry and so forth. I mean, what will happen, do you think?
Well, I think that if we continue to increase the population of the earth in perpetuity the way we've done for the last however long, I think at some point the modern food system will break down.
Yeah, I do too.
And it can break down in many, many, many different ways, whether it's, you know, it's very reductionist, so we could run out of oil or phosphate or potassium or water. It's very polluting. You know, we're killing the oceans, the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico at the mouth of the Mississippi.
Yeah, the Great Barrier Reef.
It could have to do with pathogens that are resistant to antibiotics from so much use. And it's just so many different ways it can break down.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see how it can help but break down if we continue to increase the population and farm the way and feed them the way we're feeding them.
And we've interviewed some people on projects that are helpful, such as the people in Indonesia who are cultivating lost grains and things like that, which may help. And you know the people at the Blue Hill at Stone Barns?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
sure.
I mean, that's a good model. They're successful, aren't they?
Well, Stone Barns is successful as an educational facility. It's only about 80 acres.
So the scale, and the size is very small, right?
Yeah, it's an educational facility. Glenn Roberts of Anson Mills has probably done more than anybody else for us bringing back ancient grains. He's brilliant.
He is, isn't he? Yes. So, there are these little bright spots of hope, but we have to. How can we change the whole attitude and jumpstart this reverting back?
The we you're talking about is consumers. I mean, we would get back to that. This way of farming will be at the will of the consumer. It won't be done through government regulation. It won't be done because because of some movement on the part of the farmers that just decide, by God, we're going to do it. They won't be done by, you know, any non-profit organization. It will happen or not based on the will of the consumer. I told you I don't have much confidence in the masses of consumers, but if it's going to happen, it's going to start through consumer education.
And people and consumers being willing to pay the price, right?
That's what I don't have much confidence in consumers to do.
Mm-hmm. No, I think you're probably perfectly right there, but as long as there are a few people out there like yourself, the model will exist. The producers can at least do the right thing, even if consumers don't.
Correct. The farmers, if the consumer demands food raised in a regenerative manner with high animal welfare and fairness to the rural economies, farmers will step up and produce it. Farmers are capitalist enough that they will respond to the consumer demand. Uh-huh. But the consumer's got to demand it, and to do that, they got to pay a little more for it. You know, when consumers ask farmers to give up all the tools that reductionist science gave us that take cost out of production, then you add cost back to production. And the farmer cannot afford to add that value to the product if he can't extract it back out of the market. He's got to recuperate his added production cost from the marketplace, which means, as you said, consumers got to pay a little more for it. They either will, and we'll farm differently, or they won't, and we'll continue to farm in this manner that so many of us believe will collapse at some point.
There you go. Now, that leads us to the most important point of the whole conversation. And Director of Marketing Sales, raise your hand now.
It's raised.
How do people find out more? How do they visit? How do they get some? All that stuff.
You have tours, too, don't you?
We do. So we first of all invite all of our customers to come and spend some time with us to see the production system that we're so proud of. So we've invested in cabins on the farm for own farm lodging and, as Dad mentioned earlier, a couple of dining locations for own farm dining. We also understand that not everybody can venture to Southwest Georgia to spend time on the farm, so we've got a website, which is whiteoakpastures.com, and through that there's a tab that's the shop tab, and it's got all 10 species that we raise, where you could purchase any cut that there is available from those. We'll receive those orders here on the farm. We've got a couple of big freezers. We'll pack that order and ship you your boxes directly through FedEx to your door.
Right.
I just realized we forgot to mention the wonderful cured meat products, which we just started in on. We started in on the lomo, the loin, and we have a beautiful copa that's right behind it.
Yeah. Now, where does La Quercia come in here? I was going to ask you that.
So La Quercia is our curing house. We don't own it, but we work very closely with the staff at La Quercia to cure the hams and the shoulders, and then the lomas and copas and pancettas that I believe I sampled you guys. So we don't have any of the hams and shoulders out of the cure house yet, but we hope to get some in early 2018.
See, here he was, too. We really like those people a lot. We interviewed them years ago, I think. That's another bright spot. There are bright spots. Well, you need to cheer up.
Oh, I'm fine. I couldn't be happier. You know, we're farming the way we want to farm because we have found enough customers that are willing to pay our added production costs to produce regenerative high animal welfare products. So I'm fine.
Yeah. I love that term.
I worry about the rest of you a little bit, but we're fine.
Now, as a final note, listeners, it's interesting. The only pictures I've seen of the farm and its critters is in Virginia Willis's book, which we just reviewed.
Well, you saw the website.
But I bet there are other pictures out there, and they're going to be the same. The one thing that's going to be common to all of them is all the little piggy-wiggies and all the cows and all the sheep and all the turkeys look happy.
They do.
They have a smile.
It's a good life for all of us.
They have a smile on their face. They're going to have a good life for as long as it lasts, and then they're going to go to a really good place. And
our job is to see to it that this is the best place on earth to be a turkey or to be a chicken or to be a hog or to be a cow or to be an employee, and that's what we do.
Well, Will and Jenny, thank you so much
for joining us. Yeah, I hope we can get down there and actually see it in situ. I mean, actually be there. That wasn't my idea.
You can see more pictures on
the website
whiteoakpastures.com.
Right.
And it's also where you can place an order on the website if that's your desire.
Right. And you have recipes, too. There's some in Virginia Willis's book.
We've got a newsletter that goes out every month. So if you go to the homepage of our website, you'll have the opportunity to sign up with some follow-up communications from us, which are full of blogs and stories and recipes and things like that.
That's a good way of keeping in touch and keeping your finger on the pulse of what's going on there. But I think it'd be great. Just when do you do your tours? When do you open your cabins?
Cabins are open year round. You can check the website for availability. There are 6 own farm cabins, all with different sleeping arrangements. And tours are offered every Saturday at 11:00 Eastern or by appointment.
Wow!
You make us proud to be American. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. What more can I say?
Yeah, good to be friends with you, Jenny and Will.
I hope you enjoy Virginia's book. She's a dear friend of ours.
Oh, I've known her for years. We've interviewed her for I don't know how many years, actually. So, yeah, she's a dear friend, and she knows what she's doing, too. So, very smart lady. Good people, there are good people around, and my friends, you are among them, and we really appreciate having the opportunity to talk to you. Again, now, it's Jenny and Will Harris, and it's White Oak Pastures.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, so you thought we were going south and we'd stop at the border. No, no, no. Our next story is we should sing, south of the border, down Mexico.
No. we get a lot of what I might refer to as crackpot products in the mail. I didn't know what we were going to get when I opened up this package to see we're proud possessors of Salviana Raw McGay Sap. I mean, it's a sweetener. Let me tell you, I fell in love with this stuff. And it has, as we'll find out from talking to its founder, Adriana Gomez, and it has all these incredible health benefits that I never knew that needed prebiotics, for example.
Okay, so, are we going to play this?
Yes. Listen to Adriana.
Okay.
Well, I love
a variety of cactus that is everywhere in the landscape in Mexico. And I'm talking to Adriana Gomez, who is of Mexican origin, but American, I believe. Are you on the West Coast, Adriana?
Yes, I live in Los Angeles.
Oh, good. That's a hot scene now, right?
You know, it just you just never know. Today it is cold and it was raining and it's almost summer, so you just never know with California weather.
No, I meant that the dining scene is certainly, like, so different from when I was last there. It's really live.
It is really live. There is so much happening here in L.A. at all times. There's so many cultures that just come together, and it just they make this place truly a melting pot.
Uh-huh. We interviewed somebody about L.A. Mexican food that was interesting, because what we think of as Mexican-American is not, actually, according to what he said. But that's another subject. We're going to go back, and we're going to talk about your product, which I got out of the blue and thought, isn't this amazing? It's Saviano Raw Maguey Sap, and it's a sugar substitute, right?
That's correct. It's a functional sweetener. It has the natural occurring sugars that the plant makes in the sap. So it's truly something that comes from nature to your home.
Now, it's all natural. Could you run us through the process? So, okay, I'm looking at a cactus, which you have stories about this cactus. It's one of how many varieties of the agave, right?
That's correct. The name agave has three different plants. One of them is the Salmiana maguey, which dates back 1,200 years. It is in every history book in the Mexican history based on pre-Hispanic cultures and pre-Hispanic traditions, pre-Hispanic foods. This will be found everywhere. It just represents a plant that has provided shelter, provided food, and provided a lot of medicinal benefits to these communities who didn't have access to water, especially because they live in the desert areas. So, yes, this is a plant that has been around for a long time, and that we recently found that the sap, because of its health benefits, it could really be part of it could be a staple food in our diet on a daily basis.
Well, now, everything's natural in it. The way it's so here you have the cactus. How do you get this product out of this cactus?
This is the truly beautiful thing of it. We have to wait 12 years for this maguey plant to mature and be able to produce the sap.
Wow.
Once the sap has been released after 12 years, it will only produce it for 4 months out of its lifetime. And that's it. That's all you get, 4 months worth of sap after 12 years of waiting.
That's sad.
So it doesn't rest for another 12 years and then produce again, huh?
No, what it does is it creates babies around it that are replanted, and then we wait another 12 years for those babies. After the sap is released for those 4 months, it will end its life cycle. It has no other purpose than creating the sap. It's either going to be used for human consumption, which we are doing now, or it's going to feed a flower. But either way, after 4 months, there is no other purpose to it besides making the babies and making sure it produces that sap.
Well, it takes a long time to produce this, then. I mean, how do you run a company producing this as a product?
Well, this is a very unique, and it's not mass produced. We have limited production, and we hope that with time, and now that we are creating an interest, and we are now motivating these indigenous communities to keep replanting, we will be able to eventually have everybody taste it and take benefits of this really amazing plant.
Okay. Well, it tastes good.
Hold on a minute. So your company is not producing it, you're buying it from Mexican farmers who are growing it for you.
That's correct. We created a co-op with the Otomi communities in central Mexico, where we are able to certify all of their plants organic and kosher. So so that we are able to bring it over to the tables of all the American families and Mexican families.
Well, I mean, it's vegan, it's healthy. The health benefits, now, I'm always a little shaky on these because people will want to know, I think I always want to know, why do we need another sugar supplement or substitute? Why do we need another sugar substitute? Because sugar, it's, well, you get it from cane, you get it from beets. But you say that it's the health benefits make it special. I also like the taste. But go ahead. Tell us about the health benefits.
You know, a lot of people, when they hear the word sugar, they immediately associate that with a negative definition. And our bodies need the sugar, good sugar, for energy. So if you're consuming processed, chemically processed sugars, then absolutely your body will not know what to do with it. An example would be high fructose. Or syrups that have nothing but, heated sugars. Well, your body has really no use for that. But if you're consuming naturally occurring sugars, what your body does is when you consume it, it uses it for energy. It will break it down. It will use it and consume it for energy throughout the day. The other benefit of this is not only it has naturally occurring sugars, it has prebiotics.
Yeah, tell us about that. I'm very interested in this whole gut health thing.
this is an interesting term. A lot of people know about probiotics because for a few years now we've been educated as to what probiotics are. But probiotics need to eat too. They need to survive on food as well, just like we do. And the food that they're able to eat, process, and thrive on, it's called prebiotics. It's a fiber that the human body will not digest. It will go straight to these probiotics, these microorganisms that need the food to be able to thrive and keep your gut healthy and protect you from, you know, infections and illnesses. And that's how you strengthen your immune system. You put a wall between the bad pathogens or the bad bacteria and the immune system. And that wall, that army, is called the probiotics. But they need to be strong to be able to fight them off. And prebiotics is the only fiber food that they consume.
Oh, no, that's fun and cute. I mean, what do all these probiotics do if they don't have any of these prebiotics?
That's correct. A lot of us consume them.
You're wasting your money.
That's correct. It's like, you know, I think of a garden. You go out, you spend so much money in beautiful flowers, you plant them, but you never water them. So you really don't get the benefit of a garden because they die.
Yeah.
So you have to keep buying them because you're not feeding them. The same happens with probiotics. If you're going to consume probiotics, feed them. Keep them alive. Keep them strong. So you have to buy the dream team, the food that they eat and the probiotics.
I love this. And I love this whole concept of fermentation and feeding all these microorganisms. We never even are aware of it, huh?
Correct. It's we kind of forget that a lot of the food that we eat will determine the type of lifestyle, the type of health we will have in the future. So the cleaner the food, the better it is for the body to consume and to use throughout the day, then the healthier lifestyle you are going to have. Most of the food that's processed doesn't really do much other than stay in the belly and create, you know, a bigger waste and eventually create an illness that we might have to fight for a long time, when usually the medicine or the solution to that problem is just cleaning up a little bit of what you eat. It's hard because reading labels is really hard. Usually there's 10 to 20 ingredients in the bottle, in the label, that you can't pronounce. In this case, Salviana has one ingredient. It's raw maguey sap. That's all we have. It's easy to read. You don't have to Google the name. It is what it is. What we say is in the bottle is in the bottle.
Now, was this discovered a long time ago, or how did you and your brother become familiar with it?
It was a personal journey. We've didn't know about it. We've heard about it, but we've had a my father was diagnosed with an illness, and he was taking on a lot of medications. And the first thing that happened was his gut suffered.
Yes,
he was having a lot of trouble with that area of his life, digestion. So we started to look for natural remedy that wouldn't include more medication. And we heard about it. My brother went out to research it. He was at that area living with these indigenous communities trying to find out what it was. And as a matter of fact, it was what it was. It is a sap that comes from a plant that's been around for a long time, and it does help your digestion, improves it to the point where your body does what it's supposed to on a daily basis with no stress. And that's the beautiful thing. Most of us don't know what that feels like.
Amazing. And now, what did you do before you got involved with producing this?
I graduated from UCLA. I was given a full scholarship to go to UCLA. After UCLA, I was doing business consulting. I would come in into the businesses and help them create a structure so that, they were able to function with departments and in a way that it was organized. So I was already in the business and in the business industry.
Okay. And your brother, what did he do?
He was actually manufacturing and importing blueberries.
Blueberries, but they're healthy too.
Yes. They're very healthy. Yes. He was, he's one of the exporters of blueberries in Mexico.
Now, I want to ask, can you describe the flavor? Because I was a little surprised when I tasted it. I don't know, because of what it looked like, I thought it was going to taste like honey, and it doesn't.
It doesn't. The reason it has a different flavor is because it's plant-based and the fermentation process. That's basically what makes it this sweet-like gust sap. So it doesn't have as much sugar as most of what's out there. It's only 5 grams per serving. And it has that herbal flavor because we keep it raw. So because we haven't applied heat that will cook the product, it's still keeping its original flavor from the herbs or from a plant.
Okay, but that's why you keep it. After you open the jar, you put it in the refrigerator. You refrigerate it.
Yes, because it's raw.
Right. Now, everybody sitting out there listening to this, and I think they have one question that I should ask. What do you do with it?
You can do two things, which I'll give you the first option of what I do is I take it by itself in the morning.
Well, I took it.
Because it has...
That's what I did with the spoon. Like, that's how I tasted it.
That's how I take it every morning. It has 4 grams of fiber per serving. So as soon as I wake up and I put that in my mouth, I'm already putting my body 4 grams of dietary fiber. You don't really get that with most of any of the food that we consume nowadays. So that's one use. You put it as that you do dietary fiber on a daily basis plus prebiotics. You just put in, a teaspoon, and that's you're done with your day. The other thing is, a lot of people who like to, make breakfast and eat a full meal before they leave the house or they cook at home, they could put on oatmeal, cereal, juice, smoothies, fresh fruit. You can use it as a sweetener the way you would use any other sweetener.
I thought it would be good on ice cream. I thought it would be good on ice cream.
I had somebody who here, a company who makes ice cream, who used it as the base for that ice cream, and it was absolutely delicious. It has that really tasty, natural flavor.
Oh, wow. And so how do you get this, Adriana?
I'm sorry, how do I do?
How does one get this product? Is there a website?
Absolutely. Our website is salviana.com.
Okay.
We do free shipping anywhere in the country, anywhere in the U.S. So all you have to do is go to our website, click on the buy product, and it will be delivered to you within 2 to 3 days.
Wow.
I want to make a suggestion of someone you should get in touch with,
Okay.
who I think is actually on the West Coast. It's a Swedish-owned company. that makes milk out of oats.
Oh yeah.
I think it's Oatly.
Oatly. O-A-T-L-Y.
L-Y.
It'd be great with Oatly. Yes.
I think they put some sweetener in it, but
I don't know what kind they put in.
Seems to me like Oatly pus.
It's like liquid oatmeal.
Might be really good.
Yes,
you know what? I appreciate that. I will definitely look into it today. So that you might. I think I've heard of them. So they do. They might be on the West Coast. You're absolutely right.
If you have trouble finding the contact person, just send us an email or give us a call, and we'll give you the contact information.
I really appreciate it. I'll look into this, and if I have any trouble, I'll definitely give you a call.
Well, this is a great discovery, Adriana Gomez. Thank you so much.
I agree. I think we were very lucky to find it, because I think we would definitely miss out if we couldn't share this with everybody. This is something that can truly change people's lives once you realize what the body can do with real food.
Right. I'm with you. I agree.
Yes.
So, and I'm going to enjoy it.
I felt it. I personally use it on a daily basis. So absolutely. I think the body does what it's supposed to. You just have to make sure it has the right tools and it has the right food, because, hey, you know, a car cannot run if it has no gas. A car cannot run without any maintenance. The body needs the same.
Thank you very much for sharing your story with us.
Yeah, Adriana.
Thank you. Ciao. I really appreciate it. Please let me know if you guys have any questions, and I will look into this.
Okay, sweetheart. That's a wrap for another week. We hope, listeners, that you enjoyed our journey to the south. And you'll join us again, same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.